Hello everyone, I hope you're doing well. I'm Reinhard Wolf, sitting in for Henrik Holmgren, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. For new listeners out there, Red Ice is an independent media outlet offering perspectives on a variety of topics you won't find in the mainstream. Due to our commitment to covering controversial issues, we were recently hacked by someone claiming to be Antifa. However, our public site, redice.tv, is back up, while Red Ice Members is still down for the time being. We are building a brand new member site, though, so we'd like to encourage our members to stay with us for just a little while longer. We appreciate your support, and we certainly couldn't do this without you. Our guest for this show is Kalki Weisthor, otherwise known as Robert. Robert is a former attorney with a deep interest in all things esoteric. Originally a practitioner of Zen Buddhism, he eventually switched his focus to Indo-European religion, ranging from Norse paganism to Hinduism. The show you're about to listen to does explore ideas some might find shocking, offensive, or even blasphemous. As such, it's important to approach these things with an open mind, and understand that one can, in the words of Aristotle, entertain a thought without accepting it. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Robert, welcome back to Red Ice. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Good to be here.
Awesome. So the subject for our show today is initiation, which is a term that has many meanings depending on the context. You know, on the one hand, we can speak of initiating someone into a club, a secret society, an organization, and so forth. But the word initiate means something else. It also implies the beginning of a process. And I think exploring just exactly what that process is within an esoteric or religious context is pretty worthwhile, honestly. So why don't we start out with having you tell us how you would define the term initiation within this context?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been thinking about that since I knew that's what we were going to be discussing. And obviously, as you say, it has a wide variety of meanings and probably has more than one meaning to most people all at the same time. I think in terms of the context, we're talking of initiation into a spiritual path. I mean, obviously, if you look at there's a certain group or communal or institutional initiation that goes on in some cases. That's not particularly what I'm talking about.
Right.
That's more if we do the right hand, left hand path distinction, which we made, I think that's more of a right hand path sort of thing that has to be conferred by an organization or some sort of authority. I think in terms of an individual practitioner or path taker, you know, the word that probably comes to me most is adulthood. At some point, when does your awareness take responsibility for itself? When do you stop becoming a follower? When do you stop following somebody else's path and find your own? Although, of course, you have to have the guidance from the previous paths. I think it does come in levels for each individual. There are moments of stepping up, aha moments of awareness, but I think the point at which you're going to look at what's true and what works and for you and admit who you are and realize that you're responsible for your own path, I think, is initiation for me.
Yeah, I think that's a very good definition. I think the process of self-transformation is central to the idea of initiation. Now, what form that type of self-transformation takes is varied, and I would almost say infinite. There are many different types of philosophies, occult traditions, religious traditions, and so forth that one can use to, you know, essentially change on an existential or ontological level. So let's kind of briefly give an overview of the two main forms that it comes in. We'll give more attention to it later, but so there's a dichotomy that I believe comes from Hinduism, and you can tell us a little bit more about the precise history and the etymology and so forth in a second, but it is essentially between right-hand path and left-hand path. So why don't you give us kind of a brief rundown on those two, and we can kind of return to some of the more specifics a little bit later.
Well, that's an interesting distinction to make because, I mean, technically it comes from Hinduism. I think referring to Brahmacharya is probably almost translates as left-hand path, you know, which is in various forms of Hinduism, tends to be associated with goddess worship, a little bit of breaking of some of the moral and ethical constraints that go with the right-hand path. to sort of skip that phase. I mean, what we deal with in the West, if you look at the origin of the term left-hand path, I think it almost starts in the West with Blavatsky.
Oh,
and then she talks about it a lot. Of course, she was incorporating all that Eastern stuff anyway, so that's not unlikely. That's how it would have come into our discourse. And Aleister Crowley talks about it a lot. And then you have on into the modern time, you know, and within, for example, the Norse religions and practices, which I've been spending a lot of time with on the last few years, you have Stephen Flowers, a.k.a. Edred Thorsen's discourse on the matter, where he defines it as sort of a questing for individualization as opposed to individualism, of true individualization, of maintaining a higher self as opposed to, as being the left-hand path, as opposed to being the right-hand path, being where one is trying to be subsumed into a higher reality and lose one's individualism.
Right.
Basically. But on the other hand, I think there's kind of a warning that comes with the whole right-hand, left-hand path dichotomy, is that you mainly see this diversion, these terms being used by people who consider themselves essentially left-hand practitioners in a way that's kind of derogatory to the right-hand path.
True.
So it's not quite a neutral definition. I think most people say, oh, they're just right-hand path. They're just following orders.
Right.
You know,
I have seen that.
You know, but I don't know anyone who really comes out and says, yes, we're the right-hand path.
Yeah, absolutely. It almost reminds me of the left referring to everything it dislikes as fascism or white supremacy, whereas the amount of people who actually refer to themselves as fascists or white supremacists is they're quite few in number. But, one thing regarding that the dichotomy and how it's used by practitioners of the left-hand path, I have noticed that tendency among people on the left-hand path who, I think they have a tendency to throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater. They see, defining, like just splitting up all forms of spirituality and philosophy into two categories and then demonizing one side for being bad. I think that's I think you can lose a lot in the process.
Well, I think that kind of dualism essentially takes you back to, something that started in our Western philosophy with Zoroastrianism, was incorporated through Christianity. You see echoes of
right.
it in various. There's a lot of dualistic Hinduism too, because it incorporated all the Western philosophies back. And the whole good versus evil, right versus, it's very much, I think, that probably a constructive polytheism is more useful, and that's being pursued by some of the advocates, the more open and interesting advocates of the left-hand, so-called left-hand path these days.
Yeah, I recall watching a video of Michael Ford, who's a very famous left-hand path author and practitioner, in which he was talking about how he completely discredits or denounces everything represented by Jesus Christ. And given that he's a self-proclaimed Satanist, that shouldn't be too surprising. But, at the same time, and for the record, I'm not a Christian or really a Satanist, so I think I can kind of see, both sides of the issue. But, Jesus Christ did say things that are in line with the left-hand path, like, know thyself. Granted, that was, derived from earlier pagan teachings and so forth. But, are you really going to denounce everything on the right-hand path just because you dislike some of its philosophical frameworks? It seems really silly to me. It seems like a lot of it's kind of rooted in identity. I am a left-hand path guy. I have nothing to do with the others. But back to kind of the issue of initiation. So why should someone care about this? To anyone who's listening to this and it just sounds like a bunch of overly mystical nonsense, why do you think people should care about this?
I'm not sure everybody should care about it. I think people who do need to find a way to pursue it for their own personal meaningfulness, for their own personal desires. I think people who are inclined, people who know that there's something wrong with the reality that they're presented with starting as a child, are through their lives motivated to find a way to find out who they really are. And my question was always, what's really going on here? What I'm being told is going on is not true. All these systems are fake. People are lying to me. And not in a paranoid way, but there's just the idea that there's something, it's a matrix sort of thing, there's something going on. You know, I think for people who I know many people who, you know, especially older people who, if the for the first time in their old age, start to ask philosophical and religious, spiritual sort of questions, mostly because they're concerned with the pragmatic reality of what's about to happen when they die. And there are those people, and that for them, it's still a pragmatic issue. It's not a question of meaning or existence or existential primary quantity. It's just a So I basically, I wouldn't advocate someone go out. And as a matter of fact, let me interrupt myself to say, I think it's there are probably people on the left, so-called left-hand path, who shouldn't be there. There are, you know, your teenagers, you think it's cool right. to do witchcraft. I think those people should probably, I mean, I don't think they're getting anything out of it, and they may be doing harm to others, you know. I think that for most people, the right-hand path is perfectly, it's perfectly comfortable, and initiation is not really an issue. For most people, and I see this in every group, I mean, I've never seen a spiritual organization that had a structure that didn't have some of each type of person in it, to varying degrees.
Yeah, Robert, one thing you said struck me as being very interesting regarding whether or not all people should be interested in the left-hand path. And I think that illustrates a fundamental truth, is that I think the majority of people are going to be attracted to religion based on feelings of community, based on having some kind of sense of narrative for the world and themselves that's positive and constructive. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think people in the left-hand path sometimes deride that, but that is very necessary for civilization. And I think most people can't be expected to be poring over, you know, obscure philosophical and occult texts and, you know, meditating and whatever else. So that does remind me of Julius Evola, who, you know, the Italian philosopher. In Ride the Tiger, he wrote, or I think he wrote about this quite often in other places, about, you know, the differentiated man, this special type of man for whom, you know, initiation was something that he absolutely needed. So I think that relates to perhaps more to the people who are attracted to the left-hand path. And, yeah, in Ride the Tiger, he essentially talks about how there are no valid systems and institutions, you know, initiatory organizations left due to Kali Yuga and so forth. So do you think that it's all pretty much self-initiation at this point, or are there any legitimate lineages for, you know, this differentiated type of man?
That's a good question. I mean, that's exactly what I think. When I think of Evola, that's exactly what I think of, is saying that in our modern era, obviously he didn't find any, you know, in our modern era, all initiation is self-initiation. There are no lineages left. I mean, in my case, I'm not the member of any secret occult societies or people that have reached out to me to you know, that doesn't mean they're not there. It's would we know, you know, I mean, you go into some of these things, you read books like, I think it's called the Odin Brotherhood or the Odinic Brotherhood, in which the guy Mirabello maintains there's always been a cult of Odin that's maintained through everything.
Yeah.
But, you know, so they're not contacting me. I think that's quite possible that all those organizations were taken out. Then you have Blavatsky with the Hidden Masters, you know, and Shambhala or Agartha hidden in parts of the world. Are people in the hiding under the hollow earth inside the South Pole? I can't disprove it, you know, but I'm not a member of any. Now, if you look at people who have been authentic gurus of the left-hand path, if you look at Miguel Serrano, for example, I know that Serrano was the member of an order, of a lineage. I mean, not an esoteric Hitlerist order, not anything that he started, would have had its origins in the 20th century, but was a member of an authentic Chilean organization, and he had a teacher whose name is I can't remember, but who is known. And there are orders out there. I don't know. I think it's an impossible thing to answer. I think that if you know the name of them and they're on the internet, they're probably not there. I tried to, you know, they could be hiding in plain sight, but I doubt it. But I think we almost have to go forward with the idea that self-initiation is our option until we find out otherwise.
Yeah, and I think it's important to clarify just what type of legitimate lineages Evola would be referring to there, because he did have a very unique perspective. His view on tradition, his hyper-masculine solar ethos was obviously his guiding principle. So he is judging all of the extant lineages, organizations, and so forth by that standard. And perhaps by that standard, none of the the existing institutions are legitimate. But I mean, you have Theravada Buddhism, which has been around for thousands of years. You have Orthodox Christianity and so forth. So if you're looking for just a right hand path tradition, I think most of those have survived. But yeah, in terms of what Evel is looking for, I doubt there's any Aryan, solar, Hyperborean organization, at least that we know of, that is still functioning. But yeah, I think one thing, while we're on the subject of Ride the Tiger, the kind of the crux of that book was that there are no organizations that fit that were up to Evelist standards. So he kind of wrote that as a manual, as how to use the chaotic forces happening in Kali Yuga to benefit oneself within an initiatory context. How to pretty much use the chaos to become a stronger, more powerful, more wise being. And I think that's a very useful book given everything that's happening in this day and age. And there are many people who may be within the kind of the dissident right who do have a spiritual calling, but they aren't attracted to Christianity or perhaps paganism, Satanism, anything like that. So it is a very interesting perspective, but I would disagree that there are no legitimate institutions by any conceivable standard.
Well, and I think with Evel, you have to look at a couple things. While we're on the topic of him, is that one is that to a certain extent he was reacting to René Guénon, who definitely did believe that there was a chance, example, for the Catholic Church to reinvent itself and remain a traditional institution or to be reborn as a genuine traditional institution. Of course, they disagreed on that, but that's part of his discourse. Another thing is with regard to Ride the Tiger. I agree with you. It should be very helpful in an age like ours, in which things are even more in flux, and we seem to be entering into the edge of lead, which is lower than the age of iron that he was talking about. On the other hand, Evela had studied and practiced so many traditions. His book on Tantra is one of the best books on Tantra I've ever seen. His book on Buddhism, not so much, but it's interesting.
Right.
And he knew he had the background, and he was able to say that, after having explored each of these lineages, that to some extent he was either rejecting or using syncretically before he was able to. I'm going to fly by the seat of my pants. It's just I'm going to go with what knowledge I can acquire and use it as I can. I think it's still important to do the work first before you take off. And I think that's another lesson for people who are looking for initiation, especially in terms of a left-hand path. If you still need to do the practice, you need to have a background, you need to acquire certain skills before you're really competent to make these decisions.
So, Robert, we kind of went over the basics of the right-hand path, which is generally more conventional religion. It's more focused on, some kind of higher being, perhaps. It's focused on, kind of being within the natural order, whereas the left-hand path tends to be more self-focused. It tends to be more antinomian in terms of morality, and perhaps a little more inclined to esoteric and obscure forms of practice. So is there a point at which the left-hand path and the right-hand path can kind of coexist? For example, is there a left-hand path side to right-hand path traditions such as Buddhism and Christianity?
I think there almost has to be to have a complete society. I think, if you look at any of these groups, now Christianity is kind of on an extreme edge because they have gone at various, and we won't even talk about what passes for Christianity in the modern era, but if you look at typical European Christianity, to a certain extent, you had a left-hand path. I mean, what were some of these bizarre orders of monks doing to some extent, if it wasn't that? It had nothing to do with the religious practices of what the Hindus would call the householders. On the other hand, they were also exterminating the people, the pagans, who were doing witchcraft. It's kind of the difference when you play a massive multiplayer role-playing game, the difference between the priest and the shaman,
Yeah.
The priest is raided and the shaman's on the side of the bad guys. It's a little hard to say, but I think, for example, when I came into the Ossetru, the Norse thing, I mean, certainly you're looking at an operation that is very much a right-hand path in terms of most of the ongoing organizations. There's a left-hand path. I was with the Rune Guild for a while. That kind of separate themselves out. It's almost like the right-hand path needs the left-hand path to, for one thing, do some of its spiritual work for it. So that, where do these teachings come from that are enunciated for the right-hand path followers? Tends to be from left-hand path individuals, the mystics, the seers, the sages, the people that don't fit into the organization or hierarchical structure of the right-hand path organization. And there's always a tension there at some point. You know, these people will be periodically rejected and allowed back in to the society. It's kind of a structure of tribal society. So I think they need each other. They, to some extent, they distrust each other, and there are elements within a larger organization that kind of fluctuate. But I think that, you know, there's no big religion that doesn't have a little of both. Certainly, if you look at Buddhism, you know, a lot of Buddhism is things that are very much remind you of kind of ritualistic tribal religions, if you look at individuals. And on the other hand, you know, if you look at the monastic practice in Buddhism, you have something that's extremely shamanistic in this sort of way. It's a godless god, a pathless path sort of situation.
Yeah.
I think they have the elements within them. It's just, if you go to one of their community centers or places of worship, you're going to get the right-hand path.
Right, of course. Yeah, and I think that it's important to clarify that there are many different lineages of Buddhism, some of which perhaps gravitate a little bit more to the left-hand path than others. I think Tibetan Buddhism, Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle as it's known, tends to have more left-hand path practices and perspectives than, say, Theravada, which is a bit more orthodox. For example, one kind of defining element of the left-hand path, as we already noted, is an antinomian stance on morality. It's a little bit more, you know, anything goes, whatever helps benefit the practitioner, helps further his, you know, evolution of consciousness is considered valid. Obviously one of the big no-nos within right-hand path religion is, you know, sex magic, sex rituals, and so forth. But you do find that in Theravada Buddhism, you do find that in Tibetan Buddhism. So, yeah, the interrelation between right-hand path and left-hand path can be very difficult to describe at times. I think it's important to perhaps maybe see right-hand path and left-hand path as defining particular practices, and then, you know, an individual lineage or religion could be, you know, given like a percentage, if you want to look at it that way, of like right-hand path or left-hand path. You could say, well, Buddhism is about kind of, you know, dissolving your individuality to an extent, which is right-hand path, but, you know, perhaps it uses some left-hand path methods to get there. So it is important to not just kind of blindly put things in two categories and then leave it at that.
Yeah, I think that they do make that division within religions, but also if you were to look at left-hand path practices as a group in and of itself, you would find that as opposed to the right-hand path, that there tend to be more syncretic, that they tend to dispense with rules, that they tend to be very individuated and sort of antinomian in the sense that they're really anti-name. I mean, these are uncharted waters.
Yeah.
Systemic. They seem to share that. And I think the danger, honestly, for a lot of left-hand paths that become visible is that they tend to, you know, if you go as an individual and have a spiritual experience and you feel compelled to come back and try to talk to somebody about it, you're now bringing it into the realm of words and rationality and to supposed accessibility of the so-called right-hand path that doesn't accurately reflect its origin. And when you have too much organization and too much specification going on within, say, a left-hand path order, in quotes, you have that danger. And so some of these things fluctuate between being what they are and being something else altogether.
Yeah, absolutely. And my perspective, you can feel free to disagree, but my perspective on initiation, on the occult, on religion in general, is that all of these different traditions are essentially paths, they're guides. And, you know, there's that phrase, the map is not the territory, meaning that you know, all of the, we exist within reality, we perhaps multiple realities, and all of these religions and philosophies, occult paths, are ways of kind of making sense of it. They are models that we're transposing on reality. So it's important to keep in mind that, you know, the map is not the territory. It's a way of getting to know the territory, perhaps, but when you're looking at a map of, say, a forest, the map and the forest are two different things. So therefore, you know, these metaphysical, cosmological models of reality might help you further understand reality, but they don't actually constitute reality. So I think from that perspective, one can perhaps take a step back from all of these different religions and forms of practice and kind of just, see them as guides rather than one being, you know, the ultimate truth.
Yeah, and I think for anyone who has had, I mean, I've had certain experiences that are definitely realization experiences or awakening experience for me that weren't verbally weren't easy to talk about. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of the research that I've done in reading and looking at people's organizations and paths and systems has been not so much the fact so that I could understand the experience, which is kind of has comes with its own awareness, but so I could talk about it.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of that. And unfortunately, and so I might be able to talk to someone else who's had similar experiences and define them in similar words. And kind of recognize, you know, on an intuitive level that the experiences are similar, but whether someone who's never had that experience can ever get to it from the words we use, I don't know.
Yeah, the issue of language is a very interesting one. I think part of the reason why Sanskrit terms have survived within the Western magic and, you know, magical, occult, religious spheres is because they quite often describe things that we don't, you know, processes for which we don't have words in English. You know, one particular one, granted this isn't in Sanskrit, this is in Pali, which is the language in which the oldest existing Buddhist texts are written that form up Theravada Buddhism. But there's a word called Samvega, which refers to pretty much what the young Siddhartha went through when he went out and he went through, you know, when he left the palace, he went through a number of trying experiences where he saw, I believe it was an old person, a dead person, and he started realizing these things were going to happen to him. So Samvega, just as an example, refers to this sense of alienation, this sense of kind of terror at, you know, the way that life is normally lived in a materialistic feel-good sense is not really in line with, you know, reality, and, you know, in line with facing the realities of, you know, aging, illness, and death. But language is definitely, if you don't have a word for something, it can be very hard to understand it.
Yeah, I think we tend to become immersed within social discourse and use it to explain to ourselves our own reality. And I always find it useful to myself if I'm really trying to look at something, and it's impossible to look at anything objectively. There's no such thing as an objective perspective. Mm-hmm. But it's something that might be the closest I'm going to get to objective or final in my lifetime is to look at it from the viewpoint of, if I was dying at this moment, how would this look to me? You know?
Yeah.
If I realized that I was going someplace where I'd never have to talk to anybody about this ever again or justify my experience or myself or my decision to anybody, how would it appear? And yes, and so you have to get outside the context. I mean, I do remember having the experience when I was very young actually it was an early drug experience, I'll say that, which I don't advocate for anybody, but it's useful once or twice sometimes. You know, that you could step outside of, I think I called it, you know, getting outside, step out of the play for a moment. You're in a play, step out of it. You know, what's really going on here in the scenery back here and behind the props? Yeah, I think in the matter of it's impossible for us to obtain an objective perspective or anything. We're not omniscient. We never will be. And if we were, we couldn't conceptualize it. Our brains wouldn't hold it. And we couldn't talk about
right.
it. So in terms of getting the best understanding we can from a non-rooted point of view, in other words, to escape our fixed perspective and to be able to use a sliding scale and a floating perspective to look at things from different angles, which is the closest we'll ever come to realization or enlightenment, I think, it's important to be able to look at things from these different points of view. And I don't mean just bad. I'm not talking about some sort of humanistic psychologization of discourse where I'm talking about weigh other people's opinions. I mean, actually look at it from different points of history and different levels of existence. And yeah. I think that's what this is for.
So, Robert, before we get further into the left-hand path, you have a background in Buddhism. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your experiences with, I believe it was Zen Buddhism, and what kind of led you to move on and look to other traditions?
Okay, that'll take a minute. I'll be glad to do it because I think it's important. I mean, not that my particular background is important or helpful to anybody else, but it's kind of a good illustration of what happened for me. I was attracted to, I think my first drawing to Eastern paths or religion of any kind was probably some sort of George Harrison sort of Hinduism. But when I actually started studying, I got into Buddhism starting 1980 or so, probably. I remember going to the Zen, San Francisco Zen Center back in about 1980. And it's, I did Zen off and on for years. I was never a monk. I was never a very committed student. And I would mostly as a lay practitioner, always as a lay practitioner, rather, of Zen. And I was doing it up until about 10 years ago, I think. And the good thing about Zen in particular, I think, and there, or any of the organized Buddhist organizations, besides some of the blatant bullshit in the teachings that's going around through the psychologization, humanization of Buddhism in America and in the West, is that you can you actually get instruction in sitting practice and actually learn to meditate. And I think that's very important for any kind of spiritual meditation, that you actually do long periods of silent meditation in one form or another. And did that, and I actually had an experience in Zen, and I think of a lot of you're not supposed to have a goal when you're doing Zen meditation, but I think a lot of the goal that people do have is they will come to a place where forms break down and they kind of enter into the void and see everything as temporary and everything is in flux. And they're kind of entering into chaos in a certain sort of sense. And I've been there. If you sit there long enough, all the methods drop off and the practices drop off. And eventually you're just sitting there and eventually you sort of fall apart. It's possible that your personality can actually break into fragments, and in the way I would describe it visually is at one point I would start seeing, to make it graphic, myself, my small self, break into something that looked like ball bearings and go clattering off across a concrete floor and scattered and just gone. And then when you would stop the practice, you would get up and you would have to drive your car home. You'd have to put yourself back together, and every time you put yourself back together, it'd be a little bit different than there was at times before.
That's interesting.
Hopefully it'll just, because you could organize it a little. And then at some point, though, I started seeing that behind all this blackness, behind all this chaos, beyond all this void, I started seeing there actually were forms back there. And at some point of doing that is when I think I realized that I actually did have an identity, that I wasn't random, that I wasn't nothing or the void, and I wasn't everything, and I should start to find out who I was. And it's a little bit when I dealt with it and started looking at what these forms might be and how I might express them. I think that doing the practice was extremely essential and necessary. So, yeah, I think Zen in particular in America has had real problems with, what we see as American Zen started with a bunch of basically Jewish atheists in South California in the 1950s, and subsequently in New York among an intellectual sort of group of people. And they use Japanese forms, but I think it's something very different than traditional Japanese Zen, even when they have Zen teachers. I think we have to watch out for that, that it's actually it's a good religion for atheists,
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Robert, so after Zen, after you had that kind of revelation that there is, I guess, a self, if you would use that language, within you, and it's not, a bunch of nothingness, you ended up moving on to the Norse traditions, meaning a Satru and so forth. So why don't you tell us a bit about that?
Well, it took place over a period of time. I was going through some different processes. I was spiritually, politically, I was in flux a little bit at that point. And I think I started looking at Satru simply because I'm basically German and British heritage, and I was more attracted to the thing. I think I started reading some of the auditory folk assemblies stuff, and I joined them in about 2009. And it's good because there's something about the community of, I think that there is such a thing as a folk soul. There is a certain amount of higher, of what I would call meta-human essence that inhabits human personalities that is shared by people of similar blood and background. And I think that's what I was seeing to some extent emerging in the mist behind the void of nothingness that I was seeing through the Buddhist practices. And, I mean, that's been very constructive. I recently left that organization for reasons, not that I don't support what they're doing, but I wasn't sure it was exactly right for me. I think that, as expressed, it tends to be like any other group organizations. You know, it tends to be very, obviously, it's very culturally oriented. It's very right-hand path to a certain extent, although there are left-hand path practitioners within the context. Modern Ossetru is something that, if you actually look at the history of it, it was invented in 1972. There's no doubt about that. You can look at who the founders are and who named the thing and where the organizations come from. They don't deny that, of course, you know, but it is based on older teachings. And the more you learn about the teachings, I think in my case, the more I learn that they are fragmentary and that unfortunately that a lot of our culture was destroyed by the incoming Christian culture, very intentionally destroyed. And certain of it, I mean, it's there, but it has to be recovered. That's why I started to value what I would call Gnostic experiences, not in terms of Gnosticism, the religion, but individually Gnostic or left-hand path kinds of experiences of people that come back with their own simple system, which I've talked about in terms of various teachers before.
Yeah, that reminds me of what we were talking about earlier with Julius Evola, you know, getting to that point where you realize that you, perhaps all of the guides out there, the maps, the different traditions aren't what you're looking for. So you find other ways to just kind of get to the core of the issue, which is, as we spoke about earlier, initiation as a form of self-transformation, of raising one's consciousness to a higher level. And real quick, that phrase is something that we encounter quite often within esoteric or spiritual, you know, realms of discourse, the idea of raising one's consciousness. Depending on who you ask, that could mean anything from, you know, smoking a joint to meditating. So definitely very different meanings across the context. My perspective on that is just that kind of idea of raising your consciousness to a higher level. I think it can be illustrated by examples. For example, take two people. Person A spends their time sitting on the couch, eating potato chips, watching TV all day. Now, person B is quite active, exercising, reading books, constantly improving, you know, him or herself, working to higher ends, both mundane and perhaps in, you know, spiritual esoteric terms. So it's I think you'd be hard pressed to find a person for whom person A was the superior person out of person B. So when our listeners hear the idea of raising one's consciousness, I want them to know that that's kind of what I'm referring to, becoming a better, stronger, wiser version of yourself rather than, you know, as I said before, like getting high or something.
Well, I think comparing those two individuals, certainly one's going to be healthier than the other. One is going to be capable for a more extensive, broader range of experience, is going to be a little bit more flexible because the brain will be healthier, the body will be healthier, and the organism will be more functional. Yeah. That doesn't mean that the potato chip guy won't suddenly have a realization the other guy could never get to because he's too comfortable in his own skin. So I think it's a little unpredictable.
Yeah, that is a bit true. I think I do believe that being, you know, the best version of yourself is kind of an important part of initiation. But that's true. You know, perhaps the guy on the couch is he's sitting on the couch eating potato chips, but he's reading, you know, ancient occult texts, and then he's meditating when he, you know, on the couch too. You never know. And there are a lot of people who are well-adjusted but never scratch the surface of, you know, consciousness or, you know, the universe, so to speak. They're kind of very much in the matrix, for lack of a better term. They're not interested in the bigger questions. And you know, that's okay, going back to what we were talking about before. It's unrealistic to expect everyone to have the same amount of interest in these things. But so within within a Sastra, which we were, you know, speaking about before that tangent, obviously the central god is Odin, which is interesting because in other Indo-European religions, the central god is more of a kind of a hyper-masculine, domineering, kind of like a solar king, perhaps you could say, you know, with Jupiter and Zeus, they're different than Odin. You know, Odin represents, perhaps in some ways, he has more in common with in common with Hermes, the messenger god, in the sense that he is a conveyor of wisdom. He also is, you know, the all-father. He is a king and a ruler, too. But he has more of a mystical element to him than the heads of the other, Indo-European pantheons. And Odin is definitely a very left-hand path archetype god. He sacrifices his eye. He hangs on for wisdom. He hangs on the world tree to learn the mysteries of the runes. So I think perhaps there's something about the Germanic traditions that makes it more in line with left-hand path modes of thinking and practice.
Well, I think Odin is probably the most fascinating figure that I've ever found in world religions or folklore for a lot of different reasons. And I tend to think that probably the Odin that we know is kind of a composite of several different gods. I think historically, part of what we're looking at is there is a certain, you got to realize our knowledge of these traditions comes primarily from some, early 13th century manuscripts that are probably 100 or 2 years older than that in origin, in terms of their original documents that have been put together primarily by Christians. And they tend to give you a Norse pantheon that looks a lot like the Greek pantheon. I'm not so sure personally if that happened. I've seen pretty good arguments from archaeological evidence that, for example, Odin was never the majority god in most of the Germanic periods until there was a certain shift that came during the Iron Age, at which military, for example, if you look at Scandinavia, early in the second millennium, you see a bunch of small kingdoms that are dominated by tribal groups, basically. And they tend to be like any other tribal group. There's a lot of farming, a lot of hunting, And then you see a change where civilization starts being taken over by military, larger groups, which are basically military groups taking over government.
Yeah.
At that point, you probably see Odin emerge, who is a warrior god, and becoming preeminent. And I think that's one factor. I think Odin probably shifted. It happened to be the preeminent god during the last historical shift. The other thing about Odin is that since he tended to be a god, it looks like a god of the aristocracy, of the kings, of the rulers. And whereas, the farmers will be praying to Frey or Freyra, or for example, maybe to Thor for their crops, as the god of the people or whatever. Those practices were probably obliterated a little bit more easily, and Odin was more tolerated by the incoming Christian monks because there was the aristocracy, which was let be to some extent. And the other thing is that the Christians really went after the fertility cults and knocked out the cults of Freya and all the goddess aspects in Europe. So in a way, he might be what's left. And by the time you get to Snorri, writing the Edda, right, especially the prose Edda, you have something that looks like a kind of a two-dimensional picture of a four-dimensional reality. So, and I'm not sure that, for example, I'm really getting off track. If we talk about some of the alternatives to Ossetru, like, for example, the modern Thersetru and Rokkatru cults in terms of what they think of Odin, it gets really interesting. There are antinomian, anti-cosmic Satanists who actually equate Odin to Satan rather than God. So,
let's pause real quick just for the sake of the sound. That is a good point that I want to get to when we get back to it. I do want to kind of perhaps around the time we talk about anti-cosmic Satanism, we should talk about what it is to be anti-cosmic. And then perhaps that can we can talk about kind of the ideas of order and chaos as being two kind of cosmic realities. Is that something you agree with? Because Thomas Carlson's work.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I remember your talk on esoteric Hitlerism.
I tend to think there are layers. I think below every apparent level of chaos, there's another level of order.
Again, we should be careful to not be too dualistic. But
right.
Okay. Let's get back into it. So let's talk a bit about Thursacher. This is something I was unfamiliar with before we started talking about doing this show, so I'm definitely very interested to hear what you have to say on the subject.
Well, yeah, well, the Asatru people would say it has no credibility at all, and I just find it interesting. I think it's always interesting to take rocks and throw them up against the established order of anything to see what comes out, you know, to sort of banter on something, to see how its shape has changed. And I'll just say from my point of view, one of the things I have found missing in Asatru, having come from a Zen background, is there's a kind of a higher spirituality that's missing from community-based right-hand path religion. You know, it's like, okay, I understand how to behave as a society, but how do I raise my own consciousness? How do I become more aware? And I found that kind of missing. And you have Odinists who certainly talk about those practices, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of practice going on. And Thursacru, which, you know, people will scoff at, it's admittedly a modern age thing. There's absolutely no historical tradition of it. Mm-hmm. It came out in the 90s. And the primary proponent of it is a guy named, who's writing now as Ikortu, or used to write as Vexior, who's a black metal magician, Swedish, I think.
Interesting.
I think he's Swedish.
Do you know which band he plays in by any chance?
Pardon me, say it again?
Do you know which band he plays in by any chance?
Arcanum.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I do know who that is.
Yeah. He is the guy behind Arcanum, and I can't remember what name he uses as a musician. Apparently, he only has one more album coming up. Now, I don't know if he's resorting to pure spirit. He's doing well with his book.
Cool.
But he comes out of an anti-cosmic Satanistic tradition, and he admits that. So it's kind of his bringing of anti-cosmic Satanism back to the Norse religion. And to make it really quick, what he's doing is saying that the entities from whom, and this is clear, if you actually read the Eddas, who does Odin go to for higher knowledge? He goes to older entities, Thursa's chaotic entities.
Right, right.
You know, he goes to Volva. He goes to old Cirruses, people who may be giants. And you know, if you go to an Asatru gathering and you go to Bloat or Sumbul at the end, you go to either round one of Sumbul is to the gods. Okay, but everybody use a Norse entity, and whatever you do, we don't anybody give it any bloats to Loki or any Thursian entities. Which is very odd. It's kind of like going to a Methodist church where you say, okay, we're going to have a sermon, and nobody, please don't shout praise Satan in the middle of the sermon. You know, please don't.
Yeah, whatever you do.
What am I hearing? Why are they warning us not to, you know? But if you look at these entities do fill a place within that tradition to what we have of that make it make more sense. And I find it useful. I certainly am not as Stephen Flowers points out, the idea of Thursacru, that you could have a bond between beings who are chaotic and who it doesn't make any sense. And a lot of it's kind of absurd, but it's interesting to, I think that if you look at this primordial chaos out of which things emerge, you know, in the Norse cosmology, the universe is made by the gods out of the body of Ymir the frost giant. So if they could look at it as the slaughter, the murder of Ymir and making of this art, this reality, a constructed reality, you know, you have to look at it from, I guess, some familiarity with Gnosticism is very helpful to look at that tradition. You have to look at the fact that people think that we're living in a constructive reality, which is actually a prison, and freedom is back into chaos.
Yeah.
And into Thursacru, into Asatru realms. Yeah, and actually, I became interested in this stuff, and it's very fascinating reading because he goes back and reinterprets all the scriptures. He's got a three-volume set called Thursakingi, which volume three just came out like 2 weeks ago. It's very anti-cosmic Satanist, and you know, he gets attacked by the right-hand path people and by the left-hand path people who are on the side of the right-hand path people as not dealing with tradition solidly enough, and he admits that he's filling in some gaps. But of course, we all do. I think one of the things about Asatru that's not admitted often enough is that we're really constructing from very little evidence when we do Asatru. You know, it's not as solid or as traditional as we think.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But I think, well, going back to what we were talking about with the left-hand path being about using anything and everything to benefit one's own self, evolution, At that point, does it matter whether or not it's from tradition or not? What matters should be whether or not it works. And I think a lot of the people from a right-hand path, Asa True perspective, would be, they're criticizing him, but they're not understanding that fundamental left-hand path truth. So I can understand, where the gentleman whose name I've forgotten is coming from with this kind of a Thursa True perspective. Even if half of it's made up, right, if that half is still conducive to one's betterment, to if it leads you to a higher state of being, then who cares if they were doing it, thousands of years ago. But I guess you could make the argument that, if you're passing something off as being an authentic, 4,000-year-old tradition passed down through the wise masters, that's where I would, and it's not, that's where I would, take issue with. But it doesn't sound like he's doing that.
No, he's not. As a matter of fact, he's doing less of that kind of subterfuge than actually Asa True does itself, because it's actually constructed.
Well, it's quite damning, but perhaps a bit true. If it's true.
Yeah. And now, I will just say briefly that I came to that through a book. There's a book called McPherson Bloat, which is written by, I cannot remember what name he uses, an author, a guy named Nate Vail, who you'll see on Facebook under that name, who's another black metal magician. Magician, yes, and musician.
Yeah.
he has a main difference that he sees. He's not anti-cosmic, and he sees Odin as a shamanic figure who goes into darkness to pull out the meaning that we have, which is much more traditional to the left-hand path within Asa True.
Absolutely.
It's closer to where I come out on it, honestly. I think I'm very much an Odinist, I think, at this point, even though I may not consider myself Asa True anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, the issue of, or rather the idea of going out into chaos to retrieve something, be it power or wisdom, is something that is a defining aspect of the left-hand path overall. And interestingly, Stephen Flowers, whose work on the runes is indispensable, he attributes the O-rune, Othala, which traditionally is understood as meaning, ancestral heritage, something that's passed down, ancestral property, and so forth. He attributes that to having a more esoteric meaning something that the Othala rune designates a closed-off space. And he talks about how one can leave that enclosed space off into the primordial chaos to, as I was just saying, to, obtain something, be it wisdom, be it power, being it a different perspective. So you were previously talking about anti-cosmic Satanism, which is something that might sound very grandiose and sinister to a listener who is unfamiliar with that term. So I think we should first kind of break down what anti-cosmic refers to. We should talk about some of the cosmology that is necessary to understand, to really get a good grasp of both the left and the right hand path. So why don't you kind of get us started on that?
Well, I think honestly, I didn't find it hard to approach because I had some background in Gnosticism, and I think it might be helpful to talk a little bit about Gnosticism, if you don't mind.
Yeah, please do.
I think, if you look at Gnosticism, and we have a lot of Gnostic scriptures now from the Nag Hammadi scriptures that were found about the same time as, I think in 1945 or something, being Hermetic text, which is Greek written in Egyptian character. It's very an odd sort of text that were found in the Middle East right after World War II. There is a group called the Gnostics who many of our listeners will be familiar with, who either did or did not pre-exist Christianity and certainly generated some interesting Christian heresies after Christianity emerged, who said that Yahweh, the God of the Jews, was in fact a demon, and that he had taken the good world, the good universe, and created for himself a little subsection of existence, right, for his benefit, called the material world that we all live in, in which true relief and true realization, true enlightenment, and true life comes from escaping from that, out of this material world, back into the spiritual world that we all really, that our essences, that our spirits, our sparks, which are stuck in these material bodies, come from. And it turns Christianity on its head. God is the devil. Satan has come there to try to, Satan becomes Prometheus, who has come to enlighten mankind. I'm mixing all of my mythologies together here.
Yeah.
But it basically, it's a kind of Satanism within Christianity, which, as you can understand, was stomped out, but it keeps emerging. You know, you have the Templars being accused of worshiping Baphomet. You have the Cathars doing what they're doing off in Spain and in Portugal and the Pyrenees, which may have been a form of Gnosticism. So it's basically saying, you know, you're living in a bad place, and what you've been told is bad is good, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And in the context of anti-cosmic Satanism brings this forth into the modern world. And I think it only goes back to about the 90s with that name, maybe 95 or something. Again, it was musicians in Scandinavia who started it. You can look at Thomas Carlson. You can look at the misanthropic Luciferian order, which turned into the temple, I think, Temple of the Black Light, that still exists in some form today. You can look at some other organizations, and like, for example, the Dragon Rouge has some relationship to it. Although the Dragon Rouge won't return my email, so I can't communicate with them very much.
Unfortunate.
I don't know why.
You aren't ready, Robert. You aren't ready to achieve that level of enlightenment. Once you obtain that higher level of being, they will immediately return your email.
They'll hear back. But their books are very good. And, you know, that it's sort of bringing forth the same sort of context in a world that doesn't have the mythological background that the Hermetics and the original Gnostics had.
Yeah.
And they're basically saying that Satan is trying to help mankind break out of, you know, and so Satan becomes, but a lot like Dante's Satan is the hero, you know, one of the great heroes in medieval fiction, right? You know, Inferno in all his books. I mean, Satan is the hero. Sort of, that's a very similar figure. You know, he becomes Luciferian to that extent.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you have this concept of Satan basically is used as the adversary. He's always the adversary. He's God's adversary. You have the concept of Lucifer that gets blinded with Satan, blended with Satan. Blinded is good. And who is actually the light bringer. You know, you can look at all these other things that we've talked about. And who is trying to enlighten mankind, and you have who is the snake? The snake is trying to get us to eat the apple so that we have knowledge, right?
Yeah.
So it turns all this conventional morality on its head. So it's very left-handed path in terms of that, I think.
Yeah, definitely. The idea of there being kind of this cosmic creation, cosmic order, that is perhaps smaller in size to the encompassing vast primordial chaos or darkness outside of it is a very common theme within different forms of religion and, you know, different esoteric philosophies. That's something that's found in Norse mythology, as we were just talking about with Odin, the Aesir and the Vanir, kind of representing order, and then outside you have the forces of chaos, you have the giants, the Thyrses, and so forth. So I do think that idea is very interesting, and I think that's kind of necessary to understand if you want to get a good grasp on the left-hand path. Just the idea that you know, perhaps not even, without even getting into, you know, whether the astral plane or anything like that quite yet. Just an idea that there are two opposing forces within this reality. And this is something that does go back to the earliest Aryan traditions. The idea that there is a force of light, of order, and that there is also a force of darkness and chaos. And the former, the light, is considered to be masculine, whereas the latter is considered to be feminine. And I think civilization is something that is, I mean, we know the most successful civilizations are kind of founded on that solar tradition, right? The solar principle of order, of patriarchy. And I think perhaps, yeah, I think this would be a good time to get into that today. But I think a lot of what we're seeing in the world today with globalism, with the New World Order, I think that kind of does represent this force of chaos, this primordial, darkness, so to speak, kind of at odds with the force of order. You know, we in the alt-right, the dissident right overall, are trying to uphold these organic forms of being that have been, you know, the success, that have been successful, that have worked, and the people on the other side are opposed to them because essentially they're oppressive, right? It's oppressive to impose this kind of order on people and on society. So do you think that there is in a relationship between this metaphysical, cosmological dualism and what we're experiencing today?
Yeah, I think there's an understanding of it that comes from that. I mean, again, I'm not sure how meaningful this is for the actual people who are out there in the streets struggling with the street reality of it. You know, I'm thinking of a couple of things. One is that if you look at black and white from those, you're talking about maybe a Zoroastrian or a Christian perspective. Black and white's very dualistic. But if you look at, say, Chinese tradition, if you look at Taoism, look at yin and yang, and they very much realize that they're both necessary. They complement each other. You can't have one without the other. And one of Ikortu's things about talking about the meaning of looking at the darkness is that, you know, if you're in a white light is blinding. You can't see in black light. You need shadow. You need darkness to see, to have perspective.
Yeah.
And I think what we need, I am not only a seeker of this deeper understanding, but I'm very much a human being living in a human world. And as a member of a society and as a member of the part of society that has from all our lives and most of our history held it together, I very much have to think that I'm not impartial and I do support civilization over chaos and disorder. And the death of my people would not be something I want to see. And that's very natural human. I don't mind. I accept that I had that perspective as a living human being, and it's good that I have it. On the other hand, it's nice for the purposes of understanding to realize, for example, death is necessary. Destruction is necessary. For example, the Earth would be a horrible place if no one ever died. We'd all be living on top of each other, and it would be genuinely horrible and insufferable. I've actually read a science fiction story. That was the theme of it. I wish I could remember what it was.
Yeah, very dystopian.
Yeah, you have to have disease. You have to have death to have life.
Right.
It's a necessary part of it. Disease is necessary. We will never eliminate death. We will never eliminate disease. Now, how much we might want to be sold on the idea that that might happen. That's a sales tactic. It's a false hope. It's a false reality. There is an element in our civilization that operates, at least for the last 4,000 years, as a disease. It is destroying civilization. We're watching it before our eyes. As a member of that civilization, I certainly don't like it. It's not something I want to see or want to tolerate. But on the other hand, being that we live in what may be the last days and some sort of Iron Age entering into lead, it's very important to realize, to my psychological or spiritual well-being, to be able to realize it's part of an ordered process and that some part of the universe will still go on, even if we're killed off by the infections that are in our society today.
Yeah, you raise a good point. I personally prefer the Indo-European or Aryan, if you want to call it that, interpretation of this kind of these two opposing forces. Within Hinduism, within the Norse traditions, they're seen as it's more order and chaos than it is good and evil. Both do play important roles in civilization, in the cosmos in general. So I don't think we should be too quick to condemn one side or the other. But yeah, we do have to understand, and this is something you actually said on your last Red Ice appearances. You have to understand our place in all of this and what's going to happen to us if we side with chaos. We're going to end up with, you know, a terrible, terrible living conditions. Given the current context, it's going to be left-wing, anti-white, anti-Western, anti-science totalitarianism. And I don't see how any legitimate practitioner of the occult or spirituality or anyone who's sincerely religious could support such an arrangement. So yeah, while on the one hand we don't have to be overly in condemnation of the darker sides of reality, we do have to understand that, like I said before, just kind of our role in the whole process. And I think the archetype of Odin serves as a good example. Odin is part of the Aesir and the Vanir. He does represent the order to a large extent, but he's not afraid to wade off into chaos, to explore the darker sides of things, and to do so to become a better and stronger and wiser person.
Yeah, I also think that, you know, there is the, you know, in a Tolkien sense of all things, you know, to a certain extent, we may be the elves. you know, we may be the elder civilization that is sort of, you know, we stopped reproducing. We may be sort of, we may have lost our will to live as a civilization. And while it's healthy that there are people in fierce denial about that and who are fighting back, I mean, there's almost some acceptance and some relief in realizing it's okay. There's part of me that's bigger than humanity, that's part of the universe that says, okay, it's okay for that to go on.
Yeah, that was good. We kind of broke down what anti-cosmic means within the context of anti-cosmic Satanism, which you referred to earlier. But why don't we talk a bit about what Satanism is? Obviously, Anton LaVey at least popularized the concept of Satanism within the West with the founding of the Church of Satan. So what do you have to tell us about Anton LaVey and his worldview?
Not much. I mean, I think he's kind of the P.T. Barnum of Satanism.
Yeah, I would agree, frankly.
I think that it probably did more harm than good. It did damage to any serious practitioner of antinomianism to have that taken. You know, it's a cartoon version. It's kind of like the cartoon Nazis on the right. You know, it's just an easy shot. Yeah, look at those stupid Satanists over there. You know, all they want to do is have sex and smoke cigarettes and have orgies and claim it's all. And if you actually read their stuff, it's worse than that, because it's Ayn Rand or worse. It's Dale Carnegie. Or
Yeah. It's hyper-individualism with, you know, I've always seen the Church of Satan as being atheism for thespians, more or less. It's, atheism, egotism for people that have a penchant for dark and obscure aesthetics, pretty much. But so the Church of Satan was essentially, for anyone unaware, was based on the idea of man as being a fully carnal being, about all of religion being some conspiracy to oppress man's natural, you know, carnal desires. And so it's very atheistic in that sense. It mostly sees Satan as being an archetype for carnality, for individuality. And it seeks to embrace these things that have been, I don't want to say denied, but have been placed on a lower order, placed on the lower order in contemporary right-hand path religions.
I would say it would be a good mainstream practice for Antifa, except the problem is it also has kind of a false elitism that goes with it that would be against their populist run, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And Anton LaVey said something about So Anton LaVey said something at one point, I believe it was in an interview, about how he wasn't big on how, you know, Satanists being really tied to heavy metal. He saw heavy metal as being too chaotic, whereas a Satanist would appreciate something a little more ordered. So that would be at odds with Antifa, because I do see them as being very chaotic.
I of course I like heavy metal and I don't like Antifa. But
yeah, no, I agree, but
yeah, I mean, he was very much constrained by who he was. You had people who were interesting associated with him, but I don't, you know. Anyway, I'll leave that alone.
Indeed, yeah. Something that kind of developed out of the Church of Satan is the Temple of Set, which was founded by Michael Aquino, who was a higher up member of the Church of Satan. And I find the Temple of Set to be very interesting, and I think it isn't guilty of a lot of the same pitfalls and shortcomings that the Church of Satan is. So, yeah, the Temple of Set is focused around the Egyptian deity Set, or alternatively known as Seth, whom they see as an archetype, or, you know, they do believe him to be some kind of force in the cosmos, be it a platonic form of individual consciousness. That is the emphasis of the Temple of Set, is on the individual consciousness, which they seem to believe to be the most profound and interesting thing in existence. And I do agree with that to some extent. If you look at the cosmos, as far as we know, there is, you know, this one planet floating in a vast sea of space that is largely lifeless, as far as we know. And then on this planet, the most, you know, advanced being by far is us. And the thing that separates us from others is not our bodies, but it is our minds, our consciousnesses. So I can understand where they're coming from there. But I want to touch on one interesting defining aspect of the Temple of Set, which is this dichotomy between the subjective universe and the objective universe, as Michael Acuna talks about it. So the objective universe is the material world. It is everything around us, whereas the subjective universe is the inner reality. It is inside our minds. It would also include all realms of religious experience, of, you know, the dream state, out-of-body experiences, and so forth. So do you think that's kind of a useful dichotomy? Does that help further our understanding of the inner and outer worlds, or is that a bit of a simplification?
Well, I mean, I think it's useful, sure. I mean, that's very common to, Gnosticism, you have material bad, spiritual good, that's very common to a lot of Western thought. It's very dualistic. I mean, it's also good to think of it from other dimensions too. I mean, I don't think to say that is the truth. I mean, I'm reading a book called Phosphoros, who is by a modern Satanist. He's basically saying, no, this dichotomy is exactly wrong. I think it's
interesting.
It's a totally attack, as long as you realize it's just an approach and it's just a perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I've read some of Aquino's stuff and I found it very interesting. The idea of the subjective universe and the way he talks about it it's an interesting way of looking at things, because most conventional religion is founded on these subjective experiences that people have had thousands of years ago. And by subjective, I mean stuff that's kind of, let's say, on our side of the partition, as far as we know. These visions, out-of-body experiences, communicating with spirits and all of that. Regardless of whether or not you believe this is all the product of, electrochemical brain reactions, or you believe that it is part of a spiritual reality, you can put that aside for a second to just kind of talk about the phenomenon. Most of these religions are founded on, these subjective experiences that people have had. And Dr. Aquino's position on the subject seems to be that that these entities that with whom people have spoken, or claim to have spoken with for thousands of years, ranging from angels to demons to fairies and whatever else, and ghosts, that these things do exist. They do exist, but they don't exist in the objective world. They exist within the realm of our mind, which another talking point for the Temple of Set is that the inner realm is pretty much infinite. There is no, I mean, if you think about your dreams, if you think about your imagination, there is no limit to what you can create inside, your mind's eye and so forth. So I do think it is interesting to kind of view things from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you could also take the opposite perspective. I mean, I tend to think that probably that these beings that you're talking about, to some extent, I mean, can be more real than we are.
Interesting.
The problem is saying, we have a human point of view to look at all these things, and to some extent we're stuck in it. But that doesn't mean that there's not another point of view that we really can't get to that's equally valid that we should use to try to complement. I mean, if there are gods, they're more real than we are. We're just manifestations. I'm not sure that there is if there is an objective universe. If you look at anything from Blavatsky to Savini. Savitri Devi to Miguel Serrano, gross material existence is probably the lowest form of existence that there is.
Yeah.
It's the least essential. If you look at the Kabbalah, if you look at their tree of life with the Sephiroth, that it's the least real, and I think that creeping humanism and psychologism in terms of looking at ontology of the universe is dangerous. I mean, it's okay because we are humans. That is the perspective we need to have, but we need to be able to move beyond it.
There are many questions that are very fundamental within the spiritual and occult spheres that I don't think we're going to be able to get any objective answers. I think people are going to need to be, form their own conclusions based on their own experiences. And the existence or non-existence of entities outside of our own consciousness is one of those. You know, people have been having these experiences with spirits, with ghosts, and so forth throughout human history. I haven't personally ever, you know, had one of these experiences, but I'm willing to agree that I do believe people experience something. I don't think they're all just making it up. Many of them probably are, but there's a big market for, you know, books on these things these days. So it's not too surprising. But yeah, I mean, that is kind of one of those fundamental questions. Are these entities that people have these experiences with, do they exist? Are they just subjective parts of our own mind? Are they, as you say, actual entities that exist independently of us? It's a very, very interesting question, one that I don't have an answer for, but I think it's one that's worth asking and worth exploring. And something else you said was interesting, the idea of the material world being the lowest level of reality. And within certain traditions, the material world is actually just an illusion. It doesn't really have any real solid existence. I don't have a particular, you know, dogmatic view on that issue. I do think that if there are other realities beyond this one, I would say that this one is probably the lowest, hopefully. I'd hope the rest are better than this. But one thing within Buddhism that they when they talk about this world, the material world, and I think this applies to all of samsara, which is, you know, the endless cycle of birth and death and existence, which includes the quote unquote spiritual realms as well, is that it's not, when we talk about the material world, when we say the material world is this, that is such a statement seems to imply a permanent state of being. But if we look at the material world, everything is in a constant state of flux. So there aren't fixed things, although we do perceive them as that. When you see a tree, right? Like I'm looking outside of my window, I see a tree. It looks like a fixed thing, but in reality, it is a process. It is the result, and it is subject to change. It hasn't always looked like that, and it won't always look like that. For most of the universe's history, it hasn't existed, and for most of the universe's history, it won't exist after it's gone. So, yeah, looking at the material world, I think even from like a scientific perspective, we can say that it isn't a fixed thing. It is a collection of processes which are, at the end of the day, ephemeral. They are, you know, transitory. So I think there is some validity to the truth, to that idea that, you know, perhaps the material world isn't, you know, some fixed thing. Perhaps it is somewhat illusory to an extent.
Well, I think both science, both modern science and Buddhism would absolutely support what you just said.
Yeah.
I mean,
perhaps anti-cosmic Satanism would to an extent as well.
I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, that this tree is, I mean, it's all, that tree is mostly space,
yeah.
You know, and mostly space. And so are you. But if you run into the tree, you're still going to fall.
That is true. I would injure myself if I ran, face first into it. That should be remembered, but yeah.
The matter of accepting is one's dristi, as they would say, one's perspective within the universe. A certain part of it are kind of inescapable that you're stuck with as long as you're human.
Yeah. Yeah, and before we kind of get into some of the other left-hand path organizations that I want to talk about, I think the issue of impermanence is one that is central to initiation. The idea that there is, that this universe within which we live, as far as we can tell, is in a constant state of flux. Everything is changing, right? And that applies both to the macrocosm with the cosmos and to us, to our minds, to our states of being. So within that perspective, with, you know, of everything constantly changing, you're given the choice of evolving, essentially, of moving either upwards, downwards, or staying or stagnating, right? So I think initiation is about realizing that everything is changing. You are changing. The world around you is changing. So you may as well change. You may as well change upwards, evolve upwards. And that's my perspective, not only on religion and spirituality, but also in terms of civilization as well. Civilization is always changing. So we may as well strive to evolve upwards, both for individuals, also for kind of the folk overall. Eugenics can come into play there. I think there were some people in the 30s that had some interesting ideas that maybe got a bit out of hand regarding, the folk evolving upwards. But, what are your thoughts on that kind of perspective?
Well, I mean, in terms of perspective itself, I mean, I think the goal, just for example, just in terms of which way is up, there's a question of which way is upward and which way is downward.
Right.
If I can run back just for a second to some of Thomas Carlson's stuff, and one of his favorite books is a book he wrote on Sephiroth, Kliphoth, Kabbalah, basically Hermetic
Kabbalah, Kliphoth, and Goetic Magic. Sorry to correct you, but I will say that I looked up the name of that title before, so I didn't butcher it.
Yeah. I can't even pronounce it, much less remember it correctly.
Yeah, it's a bit confusing of a name, but go on.
It's interesting because, you have the concept of the Kabbalah from the Tree of Life, which I've always really thought that was a powerful model of emanation reality, of an emanate, where everything emanates. And I think that's a good, and material has emanated the furthest from God, so it's the most solid. And what you have in his system is, yes, but you don't have to climb back to the top, which is kind of impossible. You can't really climb above the abyss and become unmanifest. But you can basically go out through the bottom, through another 9 levels of existence, the Kliphoth as opposed to the Sephiroth, and come back to individualization that way. And I would argue that there's a circle there that actually comes back to the top.
Interesting.
That comes back to the top, and there's either a spiral or a circle there.
Carlson did write that as well.
And for me, the goal is to remain free to move within. I'm the more enlightened or advanced, to a certain extent, I can be free to move around between these levels to be where I should be, to be the perspective that I think is most appropriate at the moment. It's kind of like this analogy of as people as sparks of light in a material universe. You can be drawn where the wind or where the light takes you to a certain extent. I think that's the kind of the way I would delineate my goal of the evolution of awareness within that. So, I mean, all these other things are kind of in support of that, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a very wise perspective. Assuming that there are many different levels of reality that one could experience after death, or perhaps even just in this life, I think the ideal situation would be, having complete freedom to explore all of them, to explore all of creation or uncreation. And let's talk a bit about the Kabbalah. So, and the Kliphoth, of course. So the Kabbalah the origins of Kabbalah are somewhat of a contentious issue. There is the Jewish Kabbalah, but within the context of occultism, it's generally the Hermetic Kabbalah, which, as any Jewish Kabbalist would tell you, is not Jewish Kabbalah. It does employ Hebrew symbols. It does employ certain Hebrew terms as well, but it seems to have more of a hermetic perspective.
Yeah.
And there's the kind of the more mythological interpretation of the history of Kabbalah, which traces it back to Egypt. Maybe that's true, but I think there is a tendency within the occult world to take things like the tarot and the Kabbalah and all of these kind of mysterious elements of Western occultism and just kind of just tie them back to Egypt because it's cool, I guess.
Yeah.
But, maybe there's a little more evidence to that than I'm giving credit for. But so the Kabbalah.
It could very well.
Go on.
Sumerian, Babylonian, Mesopotamian of some sort.
Yeah. Or back to Atlantis if you want to go full esoteric.
Yeah.
But
right.
But so the Kabbalah is a system it is a cosmological map. It is a map for understanding the inner and outer realities, and that would represent, going back to what we spoke about before, the cosmic side of creation, the order. And whereas the Kliphoth, which is so the Kabbalah is considered generally the day side. There is the Tree of Life, the Sephiroth, which contains 10 Sephiroth, which are 10 spheres of emanation that are said to, you start off with the Godhead, the source of creation, God, whatever you want to call it, and then there's this Tree of Life with 10 emanations from it, and each one of those is said to represent certain aspect of an element of being, an element of consciousness that comes from this higher force. So that represents, so there's the day side, that is the Kabbalah, and you have the Klifoth, which is supposed to be the night side of the tree. There is an inverse tree, which is an inversion of that, which represents what we spoke about earlier with this the concept of chaos, the primordial darkness from which, out of which, you know, creation came. So why don't you talk a bit about your perspective and your ideas on the Kabbalah and the Klifoth?
Well, let me say first, I think that if you really want to understand it, I searched for years for a really good book just to lay it out and understand. I think the Carlson book that you gave the title of is probably the best I've ever seen, if somebody wants to look at that. But, I mean, I think that it's, for one thing, it's very conducive to a Gnostic perspective. You know, Crowley, of course, not only did his own tarot based on a lot of that, the Sephiroth and the Kabbalah, yeah, to a certain extent, talks about a lot about being up above and below the abyss. The idea that there are ways in which the Ein Sof, the formless whole, gives birth to the manifest universe, you know, by being reflected first by a sort of a will to see itself.
Yeah.
You know, being the first, I can't remember the name in the Gnostic, that entity has a name in the Gnostic tradition. That therefore, but everything else comes from the sort of, it's a chain of causation that's actually fairly analogous to a Buddhist chain of causation, except it starts from the top down rather than the bottom up, like the Buddhist chain of causation does to some extent.
That's interesting.
Rather than being from a ground of perception, it's from a ground of emanation. There are analogies to planets. There are analogies to forms of the society, if you want, that it can be drawn from that. But I think they tend to, you know, just basically, how does everything turn into something particular, and how far down the chain does it go, you
yeah.
know? And where are we? You know, we're on the planet at the bottom, which is the most manifest. But, you know, and all these things, it's kind of like when you get tired of, when you're doing world religion comparisons, you realize that you get tired of hearing that you're at the lowest plane of existence,
right,
and you're living in
Yeah, it's disconcerting to see how all of the world's, you know, wise traditions don't have the most positive view on this level of reality. Take that for what it is. Form your own opinions.
Well, I mean, I just think that, you know, that it's a good model for understanding how things are, the formation of any given. I just find it really useful for modeling, basically.
Yeah, I do agree.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to perhaps err on the side of cautioning people against getting too caught up in this world than as opposed to the opposite of being too for this world, because, you know, there are a lot of downsides to getting too caught up in sensuality, in just kind of the, you know, taking this world, you know, a bit too seriously, and the pleasures of this world too seriously. Now, I'm not a Puritan. I don't think, you know, we should all be wearing, you know, flagellating ourselves and, you know, fasting all the time and whatever else. But, you know, but at the same time, you know, scientifically, you know, habitual drug use, promiscuous sex, gluttony, all of these things that are cautioned against, you know, as being, you know, worldly, you know, they do have definite downsides. So I think if you're going to kind of err one way or, you know, lean one way or another, I think leaning towards being a bit more spiritual than worldly in your perspective is good. But yeah, I do think the negative view on this reality is something that needs to be a little more nuanced than, you know, this world equals bad. I don't tend to agree with that. I think there's a lot of, and you know, Buddhism gets a bad. I would actually disagree with people who say that Buddhism is a bit too negative on that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe some forms of Buddhism are, but you know, the First Noble Truth is perennially misunderstood to mean life is suffering, which is
right.
Really irritating, because if you look into what, you know, the actual Buddhist teachers say, it's not life is suffering, it's that there is a lot of suffering in life. And once it's phrased like that, you would be hard-pressed to find someone who is going to disagree with that. And if they do, they shouldn't be, you know, regarded as an authority on anything. The whole point of that noble truth is the idea that there's a lot of suffering in life, and you know that your state of mind is a big factor in how much you suffer. So then comes the rest of Buddhism, which teaches you, you know, a strategy to deal with suffering. But that's a bit of a digression. But yeah, you know, I think within Norse mythology, or at least you know how Stephen McNallan in his book Asatru talks about you know this particular issue, it's a bit more positive. It's you know, there are higher levels of reality, perhaps there are lower levels too, but you know this existence, Midgard, is, you know, it has its good parts and its bad, but you know, the main goal isn't just, you know, get me out of here. That's something I can't really accept at this point.
Well, you know, Buddhism, while you were speaking, Buddhism is exactly what was coming to my, the idea of the middle way between hedonism and asceticism is exactly, because by pursuing that, you remove the pain and suffering from the equation. You know, if you're trying to get to grow spiritually, you don't want to be taunted by delight and, you know, ecstasy and physical ecstasy.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be in pain either. Pain isn't good. Starvation isn't good. You know, the middle way means you're healthy and you're free to move on, which is what you were saying earlier. I think that's exactly the best human point of view to approach it from.
Definitely. Yeah, I'm reminded of the golden mean in, you know, I believe that was Plato, right? On the subject of Plato, you know, Kabbalah does have a very Platonic element, the idea that, you know, there is kind of the source. Within Plato, I believe it was, you know, the form of the good, and from which point there were manifestations down to, you know, this world. So it isn't totally, you know, Jewish for people who are listening to this and thinking that it is. And I think you can find that element in Christianity, too, if we have any Christian listeners who have made it this far in the talk. But let's talk a bit more about Thomas Carlson, who, you know, he wrote the book we just talked about, Kabbalah, Cliphoth, and Goetic Magic. Definitely a very interesting read. I think it's about 200 to 300 pages, not too much of a commitment, but it's a good overview of these subjects. So he was the primary lyricist for the band Therion, a very interesting symphonic metal band. I don't think they're together anymore, but... And he was the founder of Dragon Rouge, which is a left-hand path initiatory organization, I believe, founded in Sweden. I know he's Swedish. I checked into him actually before we started the show today, and I believe he's either studying at or teaching at Yale. So that's he's definitely moved up in the world since the last time I looked into him about, you know, 10 years ago. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what you know about Dragon Rouge? I find them to be very interesting. Definitely a very mature.
I'm no expert on Dragon Rouge at all, so I'm not really very helpful there. I mean, I find it very intriguing. I've read some of their materials, and I mean, they seem to have a system, in that they certainly have a teaching and learning system, a curriculum. Which is very similar to other magical curriculums, all of any of which I think are probably equally valid for learning these steps, you know. But he also has another book that's influential on some of the Norse writers from that perspective called Uthark, which is he didn't originate it, but he's advocating a kind of alternative Uthark in which the Orru's rune rather than the Fehu rune is the primary, and the Fehu rune comes in last, and saying that it makes more sense that way, which is what some of the Nate Bale, who wrote MacThursaBlow, relies a lot on Uthark for his interpretation of the runes. So he also has done some writing in that area, but I don't know that much about the Dragon Rouge. Like I said, they won't return my emails.
Unfortunate.
That's how I can reach them.
Send a carrier pigeon or something. So, I've read a bit about Dragon Rouge. They are very focused on Cliphothic kind of initiation. They do take a lot of cues from Carlos Castaneda as well. You know, on their website, they cite that as a main interest. And then obviously you have the Uthark, as you said. So Uthark seems to be, perhaps I'm wrong in drawing such a comparison, but Uthark seems to be the equivalent to the Cliphoth, where, you know, the Futhark and the Kabbalah perhaps both represent a cosmic system, whereas the Uthark and the Cliphoth represent the night side, represent chaos, represent an anti-cosmic system of understanding things. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
I think that's what Carlson, the way Carlson proposes it and the way that Nate uses it in Merthyrsa Blood. I mean, reading that book, I didn't like that as well as the other book, mostly because I'm not convinced of the historical authenticity of Uthark. But, you know, it's kind of interesting. I think that anybody who – I've gone through most of the Nine Doors or a good half of the Nine Doors curriculum where you study, meditate extensively on the runes. And it always – Carlson raises the point that it's problematic with a lot of people that Fehu would be the first rune. You know, why would you start with a rune that means mobile wealth or capital, you know, as opposed to the Uru's rune, which is about primal creative energy.
Yeah, the forming, you know, essence, right?
And – The way that I had worked that out for myself is that I see that, for me, Fehu is data. It's information. It's a kind of code. You know, what? So if Fehu is money is actually a breaking down of value in the modern world, and money gets broken down in data, which is what's happening with the digitalization of money now. What is being said there by the Futhark is that there is a primary code that precedes existence. It may makes the universe less existential and less chaotic. So, I mean, I think that it's just another perspective that may or may not be useful, I think.
Yeah, while we're on the subject of Thomas Carlson, I want to talk about something that I read from him that I found very interesting and something that I could definitely respect. Before I do, I want to say that one thing that turns me off from some, but definitely not all, left-hand path, thinkers and you know, the systems that they create is a very kind of, you know, immature sense of edginess. Like they're antinomian, but in the sense of just wanting to, you know, like what we spoke about with just kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater and just completely discrediting the right-hand path because it's not edgy, it's not satanic, it's not Luciferian, you know, whatever. But, the idea that the right-hand path is totally worthless, which is something I totally disagree with. But Thomas Carlson, yeah. This is a guy who founded a left-hand path initiatory organization that could be considered satanic by most standards. He wrote that he actually supports Christianity. Because when you have this cosmic/anti-cosmic understanding of reality, of both the inner and outer realities, then you do understand that both do have their kind of their own validity, right? So Christianity is clearly founded on order. It is clearly a cosmic worldview, cosmic religion. So, yeah, Thomas Carlson said that, both have their place. He thinks something is better than nothing, which is, what the average, perhaps, atheist Satanist would be at odds with. But that's something I can really respect because, let's face it, the left-hand path is for individuals. It is for lone individuals, generally. Maybe you can work in groups at times, but it is never going to be for the masses, nor should it be. Nor should, you see some practitioners of the left-hand path advocating that their hyper-individualized, worldview and ideas should be the foundation of society, and that's just patently false. There will never be, like, a Satanist civilization, as far as I'm concerned. So I can appreciate the practitioners of the left-hand path that understand that having a more cosmic, ordered sense, right-hand path tradition for kind of the folk, for the overall, civilization is good, so long as, there is there's room for a left-hand path tradition, as well, because you don't want to drift too far into the cosmic realm where you start, burning people at the stake for, deviating from the cosmic, the conception of the cosmic order. Now, whether or not Christianity should be the West's cosmic, right-hand path religion, moving forward, that's something that can be up for debate. I see things both ways, but, what's kind of your perspective on that?
On Christianity?
On the idea of recognizing, perhaps the need for a right-hand path, but also the need for, left-hand path to exist somewhere.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, there is, as Stephen Flowers has pointed out, who's a big critic of all this stuff, and I think his arguments are very valid. First, there is a sort of edgier, I'm more evil than you sort of cool factor that sort of falls into teen metal nonsense at some point. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. The idea of a being who embodies chaos is a little absurd from any kind of rational conception you could have of it, because, you know, a being is ordered. It's very ordered.
Right.
A being takes a lot of organization. I mean, the first thing that happens, if you become one with chaos and truly invoke chaotic forces, the first step to chaos is you die. You cease to exist as a human being. You blow apart into a million fragments of chaos, and you aren't there anymore. So there has to be, to make this valid, there has to be some sort of deeper order below that apparent disorder to make it make any real sense. And so you have to have preservers of order. If you're standing in the white light, it's blinding and you can't see, but you need to have something to cast these shadows. The left-hand path is basically supported by the existence of the right-hand path. I think it always has been and always will be.
Yeah. So, Robert, we should probably start wrapping up here in a little bit, but before we do, there are a few more subjects that I want to talk about. First, we should talk about what you describe as bullshit Satanism. That is a term that I think is very apt for the Satanic Temple in particular. Why don't you talk to us about bullshit Satanism and why you came up with that term?
Well, that was just something I jotted down. It's kind of interesting. It has to do with, I mean, it's interesting that Satanism, as it is, ever got to be taken seriously at all. It's a mark of a certain place that society gets in. I mean, because honestly, all it is, in a way, it started out as, is a way for little people who have been raised in Christianity to say, look at me, I'm bad, you know. And on the other end, it makes it possible for those people to do it in a certain way that still leaves them acceptable within the realm. You know, and if you mention, for example, this thing called the Satanic Temple that's emerged, and you can talk about, I can put down LaVey, but at least he had an original idea.
Right.
And you talk about things that whether you agree them with them or not, I mean, you can go from the Temple of Set to all this anti-cosmic or antinomianism, Satan. You can talk about all that, and at least there's some argument for taking it seriously, at least as a philosophical or psychological concept. And there's this thing called the Temple of Satan that I've heard of that I don't even want to give too much name recognition to, which is some guy thinking, hey, I can worship Satan and still be whatever the acronym is, LGBMT, with 14 other letters that they have. And, you know, and I think that there's, now, within legitimate Satanism, there certainly probably is a more better opportunity for individuals who do happen to be homosexual or happen to
be different
in any number of ways, and which I think is fine, which is good in a way. It gives everything and everybody that naturally exists needs to have a place somewhere. But the idea of organizing something that sounds bad just so I can be like I was in the first place is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that's what I think a lot of, you know, this sort of fake rebellion, you know, it's kind of like the, you know, you have this, I don't want to put down a class of people, but, you know, you have these people using the Confederate flag and Nazi symbols for the same purpose when those things were more innocuous in the 60s or 70s. You know, I can use this as a sort of a flag that says, hey, I'm a rebel, but I'm still going to go to church on Sunday and I'm still in your fifth grade class or whatever. And I just think it, you know, it's sad to take those things and to take them too seriously, but the fact that they can siphon off people, and it's, you know, there are also Ossetru groups who are the same way. They call themselves Ossetru groups or pagan groups, and they're really just, they might as well be Power Rangers, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a good picture of these, so the Ossetru Folk Assembly came out at one point, I believe it was after Stephen McNallan stepped down and Matt Flavel, I hope I'm not mispronouncing his name. I recall people, it's pronounced one of two ways and people generally get it wrong. But once Matt took over after Steven stepped down, he issued a statement, you know, clarifying what the AFA was actually about. And he said it was, you know, an organization for people of European heritage. And they were, you know, they're all about, you know, white kids and feminine ladies and masculine men. And such a statement, which is fully in line with paganism, with the Eddas, with, you know, Western civilization overall, obviously created an outroar among the heathens, among, you know, heathens against hate community. And it's funny because if you look, someone took a picture of Matt, who is good looking, he's in shape, they took a picture of him, like, you know, wearing like a tank top, and he's got big arms and all that, and then they put the people attacking him on the pit, on the same, you know, meme as well. And all of these people are just, you know, really slovenly, really, you know, beta males and so forth. So it's a lot of these people just seem to, I think the anti, quote, anti-racist, heathens have, in order to have that kind of heathenry, they have their, they just have to kind of water down everything else to the fact where they're not actually living any of the teachings. They're not aspiring to be warriors. They're not trying to live like Thor. They're not trying to, you know, pursue wisdom like Odin. Odin is essentially a god of the red pill. He's a god of finding forbidden, you know, wisdom outside of cosmic creation. And that does apply to being red pilled. You know, you go outside of what is considered normal and good and status quo, and you go out into the chaos to find, you know, to find the truth, essentially. But going back to the satanic temple, so bullshit Satanism, I like that, because these people are the ones, you see them, some of our listeners may have seen these Satanists, they're the ones that go out and march in against, you know, fascism or whatever else, against Donald Trump, Satanists against Trump, stuff like that. So it's really... they're trying to be edgy, right? They're trying to, because they're Satanists and they're wearing all black, but they're not, you look at what they actually believe in, and it's essentially progressive liberalism. They believe in, you know, letting everyone do whatever they want, whenever they want, you know, feel good stuff. It's not rebellious, and I think the most damning thing is that they think they're being, you know, so edgy by attacking Christianity. But, you know, they don't do that to Judaism, and they don't do that to Islam. It just kind of goes to show that they're weak people, they're stupid, and that they don't have an ideology or a worldview that has any legitimacy, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and it's an indication that society has degenerated at some point, and also that we're moving towards, is I think in the West, a very much a Soviet type state, yeah, is what I see the evolution coming towards. I look at that disease having burned itself out in Russia and Eastern Europe, having moved west where the grounds are more fertile, like any other disease does. And, you know, I think that in my youth, rebellion could be a little more authentic than it is now. And people are actually interested when you had radically divergent thoughts and did immediately. It's very sad. And these people are just a part of their culture to a certain extent. They're no more degenerate than the rest of their culture. You know, going back to what Matt said, and Matt didn't say there anything that Stephen McGowan wouldn't have said. He just said an era in which free speech is more problematic than it was 10 years ago.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and I think there are some people who, you know, accused Stephen McGowan of racism, but thought that he tried to cover it up. He never, I mean, first of all, I don't consider him a quote-unquote racist, because that word is inherently anti-white and needs to be discarded. But, you know, and I Stephen does seem like a good person, and I truly believe that he believes in autonomy and self-determination for all peoples. But the fact that he believes that for people of European heritage makes him an unperson in today's society, as with you and I. But the idea, I think a lot of these types thought that Stephen was trying to hide this all along, and then so when Matt came along and said it explicitly, they were like, aha, we have found proof that, you know, the AFA, it cares about white people, when they have been pro-folk all along. But so the Satanic Temple, none of that, I don't consider any of that to be legitimate left-hand path initiation. So as we kind of start to round up, let's talk a bit about chaos magic and syncretism. Why don't you kind of talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, and again, chaos magic is something I'm certainly not an expert on. I like the, you know, you have the Oswald Osman spare stuff, yep, and you have a bunch of chaos magic going back for a couple of generations or so now. I mean, I think it's interesting. I never knew what it was. It sounds like some sort of weird fusion thing or something, you know. But I think that if you get down to the bare bones of chaos magic, what it is basically what they say, use whatever works. That's why you mm-hmm. can have chaos magicians who speak Klingon for their rituals or something. You know, if there is a complete Klingon language, I think there's a complete language written for Game of Thrones for the Dothraki or something. You could do that as long as the system is coherent and makes sense to you. It has to be, because you are bringing meaning to the symbols in chaos magic, and I think it overflows into a kind of syncretism for left-handed path stuff. Because, as I said before, I mean, I think as someone who has had these experiences which are beyond the verbal, and I think everybody has had experiences beyond the verbal. It's a question of how do you bring these back? And you bring them back in a language that's intelligible to other people that you're both familiar with. And if when you're trying to channel forces within yourself, if you have to give them names even to yourself, the important thing is the names have meaning to you. If you contact an entity in your spiritual practice, and I do believe it does happen, I believe I've done it, you know, that entity doesn't assume the name from a picture book. I mean, you can call the entity Jehovah or Jesus or Odin or whatever you want. Maybe it'll listen to you. Maybe it'll let itself be given that name. But that's not what it is. That's our, you know, reduction of a larger force to that. So what I like about chaos magic is you're able to take this and structure it. As long as you do certain things that actually empower your practice, you can use whatever symbolism you want.
Definitely. Yeah. So chaos magic, it kind of came about in the 70s, right, with a bunch of British magicians. I'm thinking most prominent were, you know, Pete Carroll, who wrote Libernol and many others. And I can't remember some of the other individuals involved. There was it's okay. But
Spare.
Yeah, Spare. So Spare was who was a contemporary of Crowley's, I believe. Was his work was served as a foundation for Pete Carroll's stuff. And then you have the Illuminates of Thanateros. I believe that was the organization that that Carroll founded. I don't know if they're still, you know, in operation or whatnot. There was a schism that went on. It's really interesting if you read into what happened in that schism. We won't go too far into it, but essentially Frater Udi, I believe his name is, he was another, another cult writer, another member of the organization. He apparently was in contact with some, you know, one of these mystical kind of like ancient masters who was actually alive. And who was holed up in a bunker somewhere, apparently trying to train some like psychic elite breed of neo-Nazis. So there was an interesting like racial element to it too, and that ended up that whole element, that whole bit ended up just kind of forming a schism in the organization. But I believe it's called the Ice Magic Chronicles. People can go look into that. There are a lot of firsthand accounts. It's one of those things that as you're reading, you don't know what to believe, but obviously some of it is rooted in truth because the schism happened. But yeah, so chaos magic, I believe Pete Carroll refers to it as being kind of a meta paradigm. So it is a way to approach multiple paradigms. It is a way to go from Buddhism to even Christianity to Satanism to Hinduism, find what works and use that to further initiation, to further, you know, the process of, you know, expanding your awareness, becoming a stronger, wiser, more powerful, you know, being essentially. So I think chaos magic might have been given that name in a bit of a, you know, intended to be taken with a grain of salt. Judging from Pete Carroll's writings, he's a very intelligent person. He's not one of these, you know, I'm very edgy, so forth. He's actually very, he's actually pretty conservative if you look into his political writings. He seems to be, you know, edging towards the red pill, understanding that, you know, endless waves of mass immigration from third world countries into the West is perhaps not the best for us, but... Yeah, it's definitely very interesting. They have Libernol is the book that Pete Carroll wrote. I would recommend anyone looking into that if you're interested in kind of getting an idea of what chaos magic entails. One thing too that I think I really hate giving this disclaimer, but I think it's worth stating just for people who are perhaps new to this and might have some misgivings about the left-hand path. None of this involves, like, when you think of evil and like Satanism and stuff. Most people have this cartoonish idea in their head that all of this is about, you know, like sacrificing babies, you know, hurting animals. I'm sure people out there do all of that stuff, but they're not actually performing left-hand path initiation. When you hear about, you know, someone murdering someone in like, you know, some kind of weird satanic thing, these are people that are just like really dumb and they've read maybe, you know, 10 pages of the Satanic Bible by by LaVey. This isn't what it's about. You know, left-hand path initiation at its core is about you know, it's a very personalized view on self-transformation that has a no-holds-bar approach within reason, I would say.
Yeah, I think if anyone who is any serious practitioner of any kind of magical effort who has had any success with being able to contact or influence powers or existences beyond the level, and to do anything that's with any efficacy on the magical level, you will know the moment you start to wish harm to anything, you will immediately feel the backlash of that upon yourself. You will feel the imminent danger from doing that. And if anybody who's aware will definitely back off from any practice which is actually harmful, unless they're willing to endure the consequences. I think it's very intuitive, and you feel it very strongly if you're actually doing authentic practice.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. That kind of goes back to the Eastern understandings of karma. I have practiced and studied more Theravada Buddhism than I have Hinduism, so my understanding of karma comes from that perspective. But karma literally means deed or action. I think in the West we tend to have perhaps unsurprisingly, we have a very skewed understanding of karma. It's just a very grandiose idea that, if you go step on an ant now, then, you know, in 20 years you're going to get hit by a car because you stepped on the ant. And, I mean, there are interpretations of karma that perhaps would entail something like that. But at its core, karma really just is cause and effect. The idea that reality is a system. When you put in, you know, when you input new information in the forms of words, deeds, thoughts even, into the system, then it's going to affect what's going on out there, and some of that might come back to you. I think that's the best way to understand karma. And yeah, if you're going around constantly putting out negativity, then it's just going to come back to you in one way or another. You know, if you walk up to someone on the street and you say hi to them, you're polite with them, they'll probably, you know, give the politeness back to you. If you walk up to the street and tell someone they have a disgusting face, well, they're probably not going to respond to politely. So I think that truth, the idea that you get what you give quite often is quite often true. Perhaps not always, but as a general rule of thumb, I think it holds up.
Yeah, I think it becomes instantaneous, too. I think you feel it as you're doing it, so, you know, to some extent. So, I mean, it becomes intuitive.
Yeah, definitely. So we did talk about evocation, which is you mentioned a bit of your own experiences. We talked about the nature of these beings. Do they really exist? Are they products of our mind, or are they, you know, external beings? So I think we should, to kind of wrap up that bit, we should talk about the astral plane, as it's commonly referred to. So people have out-of-body experiences all the time. That's a scientifically documented process. Now, the contention is to whether or not this out-of-body experiences, astral projection, call it what you want, whether or not this is, again, like all other subjective experiences, whether or not this is merely something we experience in our mind, like, you know, with dreams, as they're scientifically understood, or as if, you know, the astral plane is the spirit realm, if it is an external spiritual reality into which, you know, all of us can enter, essentially. I don't know if you have any firsthand experience with that. I'm sure you've at the very least read quite a bit. So what is your stance on the astral, you know, the astral plane, astral projection, and so forth?
Well, I mean, I think it's very real, but in a very hard to explain way. I mean, just for example, I think that dreams are experiences, literal experiences.
Yeah.
I think that the easy way to say it is just that what initiation is about, what enlightenment is about, is actually being in touch with higher aspects of yourself.
Absolutely.
Having said that, I mean, everybody can say, yeah, that's true, and kind of nod, what I'm saying is that you exist on multiple levels, and the idea of the practice is to be able to move your consciousness around between these levels, and some of these do exist on these other planes. So I can't, sitting in this room, this guy with this face and this body cannot have an experience on the astral plane, but I do have an existence to which I am tied that can.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I think the concept of there being multiple levels to the human being is one that is ubiquitous within various occult and religious traditions. The idea that you do have, right, the physical body, that is kind of step one. And then depending on the system within which you're operating, there are, you know, multiple different parts. The numbers may vary. One thing that is quite common is the idea of there being an astral body or an energy body. That is something, you know, some traditions kind of combine those into one, some separate them, but yeah, the idea that there are different realms of experience within which you have a different body. And out of body, people who have out of body experiences, this is within the realm of science, do report that they do have a sensation of a different body. It is more ethereal. It is more like what we would consider spirit. I mean, this phenomenon is the basis for why people believe in the spirit world, in spirits and so forth. And again, make of it what you will. I think when you're getting all of this is clearly these processes are real. This phenomenon is real. I mean, these phenomena are real. But you know, whether or not they are true, that's given the fact that the scientific method isn't going to, you know, objectively prove them to be one way or another anytime soon. You're kind of relying on self, you know, personal experience, mm-hmm. so people can form their own opinions. But yeah, the astral plane definitely a very, very interesting subject, and it's one that again is contentious even within occult communities. If you look at what Dr. Aquino writes about the astral body versus what the Theosophists write and, you know, the Platonists and so forth, it's all very different. But you know, I think the important thing is to personally explore these realities. Perhaps in some religions it's considered evil to explore different realms of conscious experience, but you know, if there is a creative benevolent force in the universe, I would find it hard to believe that they would create all of these wondrous realms of experience only to have us not experience them, right?
Yeah, and I would say from personal experience, my statement on that would be it is possible to travel in these realms. From personal experience, I can say that you can. It's a little hard to describe, and it's absolutely impossible to tell you how. And I think you have to learn that for yourself, but I think the best clue there is you need to pick one of these authentic systems and do the exercises, and you actually can get better at doing that. I will say that.
Yeah, it's like a skill. It's like any skill, like riding a bike, playing basketball, creating memes to post on Twitter. Yeah, you just have to do it. You have to put the time in. That's going to be the biggest factor in whether or not you succeed. And I think it's important for anyone who is listening to this, who has made it this far in the talk without, deciding that we're, secret Satanist, members of the Illuminati or whatever else, to understand that it's important not to dive in head first. If you're approaching all of this under the impression that it's fake and you're just going to, as a way out of spite, you're just going to try to do some operation or ritual to, just to, as like a joke or, just to see if anything happens. That is not the right way to approach this. There are many, many experiences you can read about on the internet of people doing the same thing. And they have experiences and they're not ready for them. So don't think this is something to be taken lightly. But then again, it's not something that you shouldn't be irrationally afraid of. If you're proceeding, with caution and you're, mastering the basics, which are essentially, meditation, visualization and so forth, then that will kind of pave the way for, essentially further exploration of your own consciousness. And again, I don't think that's an evil thing at all.
Yeah, pick up Franz Barden's book or pick up The Nine Doors of Midgard and work one of those systems. Yeah.
And it's important to suspend your disbelief when you're approaching this stuff because there are people who are materialist atheists who are practitioners of all of this. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to just adopt some rigid belief system and kind of blindly adhere to it. There are people that, think that all of this, we are highly evolved, life forms, and we have developed these very, very complex brains and this very complex realm of inner subjective experience within which one can have very profound experiences. All of that is very true. Now, the difference is whether or not you stop there. Some people are willing to take it further and say, no, we, you know, there are these extra, you know, this is more than just, you know, the products of our mind. And we already touched on that already, so there's no need to kind of go back into it. But Robert, why don't we wrap up by talking about what people can get out of all of this. This has been a very fascinating conversation. I think it's certainly been very lofty, perhaps a bit too lofty for some. But let's kind of take things back down to earth and tell our listeners what we think, in particular what you think they can kind of get out of all of this.
Well, I think that we're in a time in which a lot of people feel chaotic. They feel displaced. They feel rootless. They feel unattached and sort of out of touch with the world that they're in and with who they are, for that matter, because honestly, that you've been led and given a false model of the world and of yourself, especially, which is especially harmful by people who don't want you to be connected, by people and other entities who use those people to make it hard for you to understand who you are or who we are or what this world is. And if you're feeling that dissociation, I would say it certainly can't harm you to take up a meditation practice, to do some things that first take you away from the immediate misery that's being inflicted on you in this world and get to know yourself better and trust yourself. And that certainly can't hurt you, even if nothing else happens. But if you're so inclined, you can have experiences and realizations. They give you a better understanding that also give you a little bit more peace, even in the face of disaster. And it's not so much about beliefs. To go out and just to pick a set of beliefs to adopt is only helpful if you find that constructive.
Yeah.
In a way, what you do, not what you think, and the beliefs are just as much entertainment or anything else as they are. It's the practice and what you do and what you learn that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing that Pete Carroll, in his various writings on chaos magic, stresses is the idea of belief as a tool. It is a tool that is a means to an end. Now, that doesn't mean what you believe in is true or false. There can be a Christian God, but at the same time, belief in a Christian God, which are two different things, can be beneficial, right? So it's kind of a complex idea to understand, but belief does play an important role. And regarding faith, Ebola wrote that in the beginning of the Doctrine of Awakening, which was his treatise on Theravada Buddhism, the idea, he wrote that faith can only carry one so far. Ultimately, believing in things, that is a tool in his mind. We can disagree on this, but in his mind, faith could only carry one so far. And that's what really attracted him to Theravada Buddhism, is that you don't really have to believe, quote unquote, in the teachings other than, in Buddhism, faith only really plays a role in so far as it keeps you on the path, right? You have faith that it's going to work out. You have faith that the teachings are going to be successful, and that there's a reason to be doing it, rather than a faith in a savior deity and whatnot. Although I'm not opposed to people who have that view. Really, I liked how you related all of this back to what's going on today, because I do want people to understand that all of this is very applicable to the topics that we talk about here on Red Ice quite often. There are very chaotic elements in the world. We are in Kali Yuga, regardless of whether or not you interpret that metapolitically or metaphysically. We are in an age of degeneracy, of chaos, and unrest. And I think many listeners and, many in the alt-right do seem to have a sense of spiritual yearning, but they're not finding it in contemporary institutions. So my for what it's worth, I've been like that most of my life. I was raised Catholic. I can appreciate elements of Catholicism. It's not for me, frankly. And so I have been in that position as well of, well, what do I do now? I'm not an atheist. I'm not satisfied with reading, a few Richard Dawkins books here and there and having that be, having that settle things. So what I would advise, from my own personal experience, is just having your own personal evolution be paramount, having fully committing to holistic self-transformation in a positive sense, because you know self-transformation could be in a bad thing. If you become, you know, an overweight heroin addict, well, that is that is a form of transformation, but that's clearly not what I'm talking about. Improving yourself physically, improving yourself mentally, improving yourself emotionally, spiritually, all of that is very important. And I think that kind of goes back to an extent to what Evelyn was talking about in Ride the Tiger. He recognized that there weren't any institutions around with which he could resonate. So he just kind of committed to bettering himself as a person in a spiritual sense too, not just in kind of a, you know, mundane self-help, increase your earnings at work and be a better husband way. Although all of that's important too. But I think that's kind of the crux of initiation is self-transformation, evolving, you know, onwards and upwards. And my perspective on all of this is that, I'm fairly agnostic on a lot of these issues, whether or not these entities exist beyond our own minds or whether or not they're, you know, psychological constructs, whether or not, the same thing for the spirit realm, for the astral plane, with which, you know, people, have experiences in out-of-body experiences. My whole position on all of this is essentially like, I'm fairly agnostic, but I think that if there is some higher meaning and if there is something after death, then, all religion essentially at the end of the day is about evolving, spiritually. So if you kind of commit to that in a holistic sense, I think, you can approach death without fear and with confidence.
The goal is just to wake up, no matter what you happen to see when you wake up. And I think the less you preconceive that, the better, because your preconceptions are likely to be wrong and they can get in the way of your development. But the idea is just to enable yourself to wake up and see what's there and go from there.
Definitely. And I think that applies a lot to the alt-right with the red pill. What we've been talking about with the idea of chaos, being this great void almost, within which there is kind of a light, ordered part, that is essentially civilization, and so forth. What is the red pill if not, like what Odin did? He goes out from that sacred enclosure, from the ordered, civilized, cosmic world, out into chaos, and he makes sacrifices to gain wisdom. I mean, that is what the red pill is. This is something I talk about quite often, is it's no secret that 4chan is kind of where the alt-right came from Pol. This very chaotic board that has a lot of darkness, a lot of negativity and so forth. But, outside of the constraints of an ordered, civilized society, which in today's world is not the kind of civilization we're too fond of. Outside of that kind of almost tyranny, there's, freedom, essentially. And that's where people were able to explore all of these ideas, such as, World War II revisionism, racial differences, the need for identity, and, Jewish subversion and so forth. So I think, you can conceptualize order and chaos in a lot of ways, but it can definitely be seen as representing, accepted norms, accepted knowledge systems, and then to follow Odin's path to go outside of these accepted knowledge systems to obtain wisdom and so forth. And that is a big part of the left-hand path, and I don't think that's evil. I don't think that entails harming other people. It's not about sacrificing cats or whatever, similarly comical ideas some people tend to hold about the left-hand path.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of the red pill, look where it comes from. It comes from the Matrix. And when you take the red pill, you just wake up and see what's really going on. That's all it is.
Absolutely.
The whole situation we're in the world, I think what's so frustrating for those of us who don't know how to get out of this mess is if you realize everybody would just wake up and look around and see what's really going on, the whole situation would resolve itself in a matter of a day or two. If people just saw what was going on, they would just stop.
Yeah.
I mean, it's impossibly, frustratingly impossible to make that happen because people just can't get out. I don't know what it takes. It's individual work and it's probably different for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Taking the red pill is in its own way an initiatory transformation. You can't, you can throw all of the statistics, the facts, the data at someone, but you know, they're not going to budge unless they're ready. And obviously, some people are too stupid or too brainwashed to really, or perhaps they even have some psychological issues. You know, there are people who, you know, they find themselves married to a person of a different race, and that just prevents them from having any non-controversial opinions on race, which I think is unnecessary. I think, you know, even if you're a white guy with an Asian girlfriend, you can still come to all of these realizations. But I think that kind of, you know, such an example would prevent it. But yeah, I mean, it's that takes us back to the idea of self-transformation. That's just kind of a core human issue, and it's it does apply to politics, to understanding what's going on in the world, and that's what the alt-right is doing. We are essentially initiating our people, and as many people as will listen, into our worldview, which, you know, at this point, I think the alt-right is so diverse that it's not really a rigid ideology. You have monarchists, you have identitarians, national socialists in smaller numbers, you know, fascists, whatever else, even people who don't, you know, ascribe to a particular political ideology. But at this point, I think it's really just united in just basic facts that are suppressed by the mainstream. I don't want to go too much into the case of James Damore, the Google manifesto guy, but he's a perfect example. This guy is like citing psychological journals, and it, you know, doing that at this point is so damaging to this false progressive regime that he loses his job. So yeah, I mean, initiation, taking the red pill, everything that we've been talking about for the past few hours, I think it's very relevant to what is going on in the world today.
You never know what'll work. I mean, I was sitting at my computer one night. I stumbled upon Saga, the singer Saga, singing Ode to a Dying People. And I played it over and over, and I started crying. And I was transformed in some way that nothing outside of a religious experience has ever done. Yeah. You just don't know what to say. You just have to prepare yourself.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think part of the reason the alt-right has been so successful is because we incorporate humor. We incorporate you know, we are on various mediums. We're fighting a culture war, and we're not just, you know, throwing facts, dull facts at people all day. That approach is valid, but it's not the only thing that's going to work. We have to speak to people on a mythic level. We have to really motivate people emotionally and spiritually, and I think we have done that quite successfully. But, Robert, this has been a fantastic talk. I'm really glad that we had you on again. Before we go, would you like to tell everyone where they can find, you know, more of your stuff on the Internet?
Yeah, I mean, I write a blog, which has become infrequent lately, but I still write there. The main blog is at kalkivisor.net. Can you put the link up somewhere on the
video? Yeah, we'll have that in the show notes.
It's kalkiwisthor.net is .net, rather, is the website. Other than that's about it now. There's no book.
That narrows it down. Now people know precisely where to find you.
Exactly. On Facebook, of course, as long as they'll let me remain there.
Yeah, they recently banned me, so I think all of our days are numbered, unfortunately. But anyways, Robert, thanks again for coming on the show, and we'll definitely have to do this again at some point.
Thank you, Reinhardt.